this evening, we are in number 10, service. Service in the 14 habits of highly effective disciples. Service. We talk about service a lot. For some people, service means what we do on Sunday and other times. For some folks, service is doing for others. For some folks, service is letting somebody else do. But here we have this idea of service, and I know that at the beginning of the chapter, your writer talked about a few excuses that people give as to why it's difficult to serve other people or why they don't serve other people. But I wanted to just kind of, as we begin tonight, what makes it hard for some Christians to serve other people? What do you think? Okay. Sometimes it does. One of the excuses is I'm too busy. Or I've got this to do and I really can't and that kind of thing. And it infringes on your time. Okay. You don't know how they'll react. And a lot of times these days, that's the thing that drives folks not serving others or not talking to others, because you never know how folks are going to react these days. People used to welcome you knocking on the door and sitting down and chatting on the front porch or somewhere, and probably for the last 15 years, it's a dangerous proposition oftentimes. Well, you might be, and I still remember a few years ago when we were going around doing some canvassing on the other side of Highway 25 in housing development on the left. Some of us were out there, and Jim McCoy and I got our lives threatened because we were walking across the front yard to speak to this guy that was out there with his son. And he said we had 30 seconds or he was going inside and he was going to get a sort of weapon and we would be sorry. So sometimes people don't know what they're going to do, how they're going to react.
Did he know y'all were just sitting in church?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we told him as we were heading across there. He used a few choice words to tell us that he didn't want us there. Nah, he's a Pentecostal. He's speaking to some kind of... No. 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 I don't think he was I don't think he was churched at all. Not from what he said. Other reasons that maybe Christians don't serve people quite as much these days. Not as easy to get around, and besides, you don't have vacation or sick days anymore. That's what I've been told. I've been told when you retire, you lose all your vacation and sick time. So, right, that's true. Well. Y'all did a wonderful job, and I thank you very much. See, I gave you your, but no. See, I gave you your compliment. Right. Some people don't want to go out and help others out because they've seen the system abused. Right. Yeah, that guy stands on the side of the interstate and he has that sign. And then one day I watched him. I didn't. Somebody, but this is a true story. A colleague of mine said the guy stood up for weeks. But he said one day late in the day, this is down Anderson. Of course, you know those Anderson County people. No, it was down in Anderson where you get off for Highway 81 when there used to be a truck stop on the right hand side there. And he said, late afternoon one time, it was just before dark. He said, and that guy. He said, I happened to pull up just after he had packed up his sign, folded it up, and was heading across with his backpack. He said, and I was at the traffic light and watched him get in a van that couldn't have been more than 2 years old and drive off. So, people say, they lie and they use the system. Or they abuse the goodwill of others. I've heard that. Don't have any extra money to do. Well, that I don't know.
If I give money to somebody and they use it wrong, then that's their fault.
Right.
I judge it with my intentions.
Yeah, it's on them if you do that. What I've, you know, what I have done, if I feel led to do something, I tend to, and especially if they're holding a sign that says hungry or will work for food, I'll go to the quickest fast food, get them one of those big meals, one of the big meals with a drink, and I'll come back. And I will tell you that most of the time when I do that, they take the food, although I have had a few times where people didn't. I don't want the food. I want the money. Okay, well, I drive right on off. I did that one.
I have a hard time with that. I saw a documentary one time about people in San Francisco.
Right. Right.
On the road, on the street downtown, begging. And it was telling how much some of them made a week doing that.
Right.
Rather than working, just sitting there.
Well, that's.
I mean, it's $500, $600 a week.
What you mean, rather than working? That might be a good job.
Well, evidently it is.
Yeah, well, yeah. Kind of like the old joke where, you know, the guy's sitting there with his glasses on the blind guy, and after somebody drops in something that didn't make noise, but it rustled when he looked, and he lifted up his glasses and looked, see what it was. Right. It does. That, what it does, it taints our view of other folks, et cetera. And so that does happen. But a lot of folks, and at least nobody said, and I started to say nobody can use the final excuse that he wrote down. He said, somebody said, my favorite answer was this one. What makes it hard to serve others? Others.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can be. That can be. But the interesting thing is, you know, we think of service and we think, well, when we have the time or when we've got this, or we'll do it on occasion. The teachings that we find from Jesus and both in Mark and in John, we could go other places and find them as well. And certainly from James, is that serving other people is not an option. Serving other people is not an elective. It's something that Jesus commands for his followers to do, to find ways to serve. We may not have a lot of money to give to those folks, but we can find ways to serve in small ways. And it can be as simple as helping someone who obviously is struggling with packages or struggling, without running off of the packages, struggling with packages or struggling to get across the street or something to help them out, to something where, you know, you work on a Habitat for Humanity house or other things like that. The Operation Christmas Child is an example. The Walk for the Homeless that we did, the World Hunger Luncheon, and all kinds of other things. And then there are those who just simply every now and then drop in and check up on somebody or make a phone call to check up and to give them someone with whom to talk. That is service. You got on speed dial? Well, I had someone recently who wants to give some money to the church and said, you know, I want to do it before the end of the year. So said I, and this person said, I get stuff from about 100 different charities, and I try to give about 80 or 90 of them a little bit of something. So have to be careful, just like my mother used to.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
but.
Yeah. A few years ago, I decided I was going to donate to Archibald and Alzheimer's Association. So I wrote a check, put it in place. Long after that, I must have had 10 different things, different organizations for me to donate. I said, well, that's the last.
Yeah, it's the share mailing list.
Never happened in the mold.
Yeah.
You get on that computer and it's all.
But, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we screen all our calls now.
And yet, here we have Jesus saying, serve. In Mark, I think we need to have discretion. Yes, those in need. The poor, the oppressed, those who are in true need. In the Gospel of Mark, and there's a passage from Mark, a passage from John, a passage from James tonight. In the Gospel of Mark, there is a recurring theme, goes over and over again. The 12 disciples are constantly misunderstanding Jesus' teachings. They're confused by Jesus' teachings. They don't even understand the parable of the soils, and he has to explain it to them. And yet they grew up in an agrarian society. They should understand those kinds of things. But they're constantly doing this, even after Jesus predicts his own death. There are three major predictions in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus makes about his own death, and these are kind of juxtaposed later with Simon Peter, who should have understood, but then he denies Jesus three times. These three major times are in chapter 8 of Mark, verses 31 and following. And this is after Jesus says, "Who do men say that I am?" And Simon Peter says, "I say you're the Christ." And it says, and he charged them to tell no one. Then he began to tell them about how he was going to suffer and die. And Simon Peter rebukes him and he says, "Get behind me, Satan. You're not thinking like God. You're thinking like men." In chapter 9, and also here in chapter 10, we have those predictions. And in each particular instance, the disciples misunderstand. They're confused. In fact, there's kind of a this, what happens is Jesus will predict his death. The disciples will misunderstand. And then that will be followed in the Gospel of Mark by a teaching by Jesus about the true cost of discipleship. It varies depending on where the passage is, but about the true cost of discipleship. It's not something cheap. It's not something easy. But rather, it involves costly service on behalf of others. Now, here in Mark chapter 10, in this focal passage, Jesus is teaching about service. And he calls on the disciples to develop a habit of service, of looking to serve others. In fact, all of these passages tonight teach that serving others is not an option. As I said, it's something expected. But here we go in Mark chapter 10, verses 35, and actually we'll jump back to verse 32. They were on the road again, going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. He took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, "See, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death." So here he's making a prediction about his impending death. "Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit upon him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise again." So he says, "I'm going to die. I'm going to go there. I'm going to be beaten. The Gentiles are going to kill me." The reason he says that is because he knows, and they know, under the Romans, the Jews could not put a man to death. They could kill a goat, but they couldn't put a man to death. Capital punishment was reserved by the Romans for them. So he tells them about this, and immediately, what happens? What do James and John do? Yeah. Well, if you're going to die, but you're going to have a kingdom, we want to be there. And we want to be right beside you, one on each side. We want power. And if by chance it's not going to be somewhere else, but it's going to be on earth, they still wanted power. In any instance, James and John, who were the sons of Zebedee, sons of thunder they were called, because of tempers that flared easily, came forward and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. We've been following you. Now, what we ask of you, we want you to do." I know none of us ever pray to God that way. But there are people in the world who do. Who do. He knew what they wanted, but he asked them anyway so that they'll vocalize it. And what did they want? Okay, one to be sitting on the right-hand side and one to be sitting on the left-hand side. Those were the two most favored positions other than the throne. They thought they'd get to help reign and rule, and if the kingdom was in the kingdom of God in the next life, they thought they'd get to help judge.
I just don't understand that. You know,
Well,
talk about streets of gold and the Biltmore House and all this kind of stuff for everybody.
Well, and that was, and in those descriptions, especially in the book of Revelation, you're talking about people who are being persecuted by the Romans. They don't have anything. They don't have any power. And they're being encouraged to stand fast even in the face of torture and death. And that imagine a city that's made of precious metals and jewels and the most precious that you know of, and heaven's going to be greater than that, to encourage them. That's true. But Jesus, but they're wanting, wherever it is, they're wanting the power. They want to be able to judge. They want to be able to, they want to be able to stick it to any of their enemies that come up in front of the throne. That power and authority. So Jesus said, what do you want? And they said, we want to sit here. Jesus said, you don't have a clue what you're asking. You really don't, because if you're going to do that, you've got to follow me. And you've got to do what I do. And he said, are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? He said, oh, yeah, we are. Sure. We're Big Bad James and John. Big Bad John. Big John. But in parallel passage in Matthew, yes, she does. But here it's them. But the cup, what did the cup symbolize? Sacrificial death. In Judaism as a whole, the cup oftentimes represented God's divine judgment and punishment for sin. And so when Jesus says, you think you can drink this same cup? Oh, sure. They didn't have a clue. Because they were thinking it was a cup of power, not this cup of sacrificial death. So they're confused. They don't understand. And Jesus said, or be baptized with a baptism. That I have to go under. Baptism, or being underwater in the Old Testament, was a picture of being overwhelmed by calamity, like the flood. So, you really think you can do this? You can put up with all of this, what's going to come my way? Up to death. But before death, what's he got to get? Calamity. Overwhelmed with beatings and torture and all kinds of things. But they said, oh, sure. Why? Because they've still got those stars in their eyes. Just think, we'll be up there. Everybody said, who's that that Jesus is with? It's James and John. Not who's with Jesus, but who's that that Jesus is with? It's James and John. That's what they're thinking. In other words, they saw greatness as having that kind of power and authority. And Jesus said, well, the cup I drink, one day you will. One day you're going to die, and you're not going to die a pleasant way either. And you'll have the same baptism, but to sit at my right or my left, that's not my prerogative. That's for those for whom it has already been prepared by God. Well, you know what happened. They were loud and boisterous, and the ten heard it, and they did what? Now, we're talking about service here. Serving Jesus, serving God. We want to be up front. And everybody else said, whoa, hold on, time out. Let's go in the back room and fight this out and see who can come out. And sometimes before weddings at rehearsals, and they'll talk about, the best man. I'll say, okay, how did you guys really decide who was the best man here? Did you fight it out? Well, no, I'm his best friend. I said, yeah, but are you really the best man here? So far, I hadn't gotten anybody to fight. But they say, oh, yeah, well, then the other disciples hear, and they respond with anagakteo, indignation. Indignation. That word is only used in the Greek text 7 times in the entire New Testament. Indignation. And so they're ready to fight. So wait a minute. What makes you guys so good? So in the midst of all of this, when, once again, what they're doing is they're vying for positions of authority and power. And Jesus says, hold on, time out, guys. your understanding of power, your understanding of authority is based on the world's understanding of power and authority. But in my kingdom, let me tell you where real greatness lies. He redefines their identity and their power. And what does he say? Right. The one who wants to become great must be your servant. In other words, the formula with Jesus is greatness equals service. Greatness equals service. Absolute service. In fact, Jesus says, you know, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve. If your teacher, your leader, he says, is the one who comes here and you're following him, but he serves, guess what? You're supposed to do the same thing. God's kingdom is not about who will be greatest, but who is willing to serve others. Who is willing to serve others? He said, you know, I came not to be served, but to give my life. The Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many. Ransom's a price paid to redeem your property. But the word, this particular word for ransom, lutron, is only used here. And in the parallel passage in Matthew 20, verse 28. Only place in the entire New Testament this word's used. And it focuses on service now, not off in the future. It's in the present tense, and it focuses on serving now. Came not to be served, but to serve. Present tense in Greek always carries with it the present and the immediate future. So this service is not something we wait and say, oh, well, we'll serve God around His throne and we'll sing and play our harps and all that kind of stuff. No. The service is supposed to start now, Jesus says. Now on earth. It's a mindset and a practice of service which will lead others to know of Christ's service. Why? Because we serve. And so here Jesus gives this teaching of service. But you know, teachers can teach and not do, and that really doesn't do a whole lot for what they, you know, for what they teach. So Jesus gives this teaching, you're to die to self. The Gentiles, he said, you know, the Gentiles, well, their rulers lord it over them. I mean, that's why Pontius Pilate's here, and everybody was afraid of Pontius Pilate. And actually, Pontius Pilate wasn't the wimp that we sometimes paint him to be. We know from other writings that Pilate got up early in the morning to render his judgments, and he tended to be rather ruthless with his judgments. And he did that early in the morning so that he could go out and do whatever he wanted to later and didn't have to be bothered by anybody else. But Pontius Pilate was not one who gave easy judgments. Part of the reason he was where he was. Because the way he ruled and the judgments he gave and the way he used his troops helped keep people in line. That's why he was where he was. He said, so the Gentiles, like Pontius Pilate and others, they rule with a hard hand. And their great ones are tyrants. Notice he doesn't just say, well, you know, they're tyrants. They're tyrannical with all that they do. But it is not so among you. When he says it is not so among you, he means it is not so now, nor will it ever be, that that's how you do. But whoever will be the greatest will be servant. In other places he said, in Matthew, whoever will be first will be the last. So he gives this teaching, but was he willing to back it up? Fast forward to John chapter 13. Another very familiar passage, one that we don't talk about a whole lot in Baptist churches, because not too many people that want to get a basin and stick their feet in it. Really, really interesting. Last spring, Mary didn't have the wedding, but she was doing the second wedding block at Furman, And in the first wedding, she had heard this was going to take place. And we got there after they had finished the wedding, but the little brass container about yay long and about that wide and about that deep was still up on the altar. The bride and the groom took turns washing each other's feet as part of their wedding ceremony, which was just kind of different. But Jesus here gives a strong example of service by modeling that service. He's been telling them over and over again, you know, first is last, all this kind of stuff. We get to chapter 13. And by the way, in the Gospel of John is divided a lot of different ways, but some scholars divide it into two major books. Two major books. The first 12 chapters are sometimes called the Book of Signs, because the signs and the wonders, the signs, this was a sign, this was a sign, this was a sign. Chapters 13 through 21, the Book of Glory. But the teachings in 13 through 17, which includes Jesus' high priestly prayer in 17, that they may all be one. These chapters, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, all the teachings there take place on the night of that Last Supper before his arrest. So those five chapters all take place. Jesus gives all of these teachings and all of these prayers the night he's arrested, prior to that. During the Passover festival, which is really kind of interesting because John really doesn't have it as a Passover meal, though it truly is. They're at a communal meal, and what happened, if you went to eat at someone's home, a communal meal, and you walked in from outside the streets, the fields, whatever, and you're going to this meal, and your feet are dirty and dusty, what happened? Your feet were cleaned by whom? What? Well, here he does, but the host's servant. The host wasn't going to clean them. The host said, he picked out the lowest servant on the totem pole and gave them the task of washing the feet, washing the dirt, the dust. Hopefully you didn't step in a cow pile on the way over, but that servant had to wash your feet. No questions asked. In fact, that was a sign that you were the low one on the totem pole of all the servants if your master said, go over here and wash these people's feet when they get here. You are the least of the slaves. You're the least of the slaves. And here, Jesus is their teacher, and Jesus is their Lord, and it's Jesus who should sit there and one of the disciples come wash his feet, right? But Jesus not only taught you had to serve and he came to serve, then Jesus here models that service. He models that service. And starting in verse 12 through 16, after he had washed their feet. Now before that, he washes their feet. And Simon Peter says, you're not washing my feet. And he said, well, if you don't let me do that, then you will have no share with me. I'm trying to teach you something here, and I'm trying to do something for you. And if you won't let me wash your feet, verse 8, he says, then basically, get out of here. You got no part of it. Peter said, okay, well, if that's the case, then let's just do this thoroughly. You can wash my hands and my head, too. I mean, if washing the feet's going to be great, let's go ahead and get my head washed. Bring in the head and shoulders. You know, my hands, this kind of stuff. Jesus said, no. One who's bathed doesn't need to wash except for the feet, but is entirely clean. You're clean, but not all of you, for he knew who was to betray him. After he had washed their feet, though, so he models this. Here, the Lord, the teacher, the highest one in the room, the highest one on earth, instead of sitting back and saying, okay, wash my feet, he takes off his robe, he wraps a towel around his waist, he gets a basin of water, and he goes and washes every one of those disciples' feet. Kneeling in front of them, he washes their feet. And afterwards, he put on his robe and came back and said, "Do you know what I've really done to you?" So I'm thinking, "Oh yeah, you cleaned my feet." But there was a deeper meaning to this. And what was that mean? That's right. Serve. To be more like him. He said, what have I done to you? Well, obviously he washed the feet, but what he was talking about, he had done something. He was doing something inside of them. If they really thought about this, he was changing them inside in their mindset. Here the teacher and Lord chose to take upon himself the dirtiest task, the humblest task whatsoever. And what he's saying to them, changing them inside. He's trying to get them to have an other-centered love. To care about others, even before themselves. It's less about exercising position and more about emptying self to serve. But that also means we have to be willing to stand in solidarity in places that perhaps we're not all that comfortable. Or for people with whom we're not all that comfortable. As one writer puts it, true disciples follow Jesus' example of serving others. There is no act of service that is beneath Jesus' disciples. If the teacher himself, if the Lord himself takes the lowliest task and does it for us, there is no task beneath us. I tell you, the servants are not greater than the master, nor are messengers greater than the one who sent them. So this is what I've done. I've taught you this lesson by doing it myself. And then he says, if you know these things, you are blessed. But he doesn't stop there. What does he say? If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. If Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who do the will of my Father who sent me. That's the same thing here. He said, if you really know these things, you will be blessed, but only if you do them. Jesus very often connects belief or faith and action. They're flip sides of the same coin. It's not just enough to say, I believe, then one has to act upon it. By the way, the only other place that this word for blessed is used in the Gospel of John is in chapter 20, verse 29. After Thomas says, my Lord and my God, Jesus said, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet come to believe. This is not just an outward blessing. This is a blessing that's internalized. But it's internalized not so that we can say, boy, I got this warm feeling in my heart, but so that we then go out and serve. And I know all this, we talk about this, this sounds redundant, but it's not that easy to do, is it? I'll get around to that tomorrow. But Skinny, see if you can catch me tomorrow, because I knew I wasn't going to be there tomorrow. But when you get to tomorrow, tomorrow has become today, and today is yesterday, so in some ways, tomorrow may never come. Right? It's not to say, okay, well, I'll get around to it tomorrow, but rather, Jesus says, today. Today. Which then brings us to James. Now, part of the reason James made it into the canon, the letter of James made it into the canon, is because there was a possibility it may have been written by James, the brother of Jesus, who became a leader in the church in Jerusalem. Before that, it had a hard time getting into the canon. Some of that may be in part because James says some really hard stuff. But James doesn't say anything any harder than what Jesus says about serving. Jesus says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom, but those who do the will of my Father. That's faith and works. That's proper theology and proper action based on it. Even Paul, though some people say no, Paul in Galatians chapter 5 says there's a new law, faith working through love. That's faith and works. But James is the keynote or the premier proponent that we think about when we think about faith and works, right? I mean, he says multiple times, faith without works is dead. Just as a body without a spirit is dead, so faith if it has no works is dead. And a lot of folks don't like that because that's a hard saying. We want it to be, oh, well, I went down the aisle and I said I believed and I accepted Jesus in my heart and that ought to be enough. Now I'm going to go about the rest of my life. But that's not what James says. James fuses together in even a more concrete fashion what Jesus had taught earlier about proper belief must be followed with proper action. It's not an elective. We like to make it an elective, right? But it's not an elective. He combines proper theology with proper action. James chapter 2, verses 14 through 17. Of course, I'm going to mention James chapter 4 in a moment, too. Looking at the clock. While right action is not necessary for salvation, proper action is not only the byproduct of salvation, proper action or activity for many and for James is the evidence that you really have a true saving faith. If you don't act upon it, James raises the question as to whether you even really had a saving faith or not. That's tough. You want to get somebody's hackles up real quick? They talk about their belief, and they say, okay, well, what do you do with that? Oh, well, I go to church, and I do this, and I do that. I give my money. Well, do you tithe? Well, I give my money. Like I said the other Sunday, the latest study is it's up a little bit. It's gone up to 3%. Or 3.5%, but the average Baptist gives 3.5%. A couple of years ago, it was between 2 and 3%. But here, you know, but you want to get somebody's hackles up, ask them and say, well, what did you do? Well, I go to church and I do this. And I said, but do you help us? Well, no, we got missionaries to do that. We got the preacher to do that. We got the deacons to do that. And then say, well, you know, according to Jesus and James both, if you're not doing something with that, there's a real question about whether you're going to make it in the kingdom of God. And boy, you better duck real quick. Yeah. Well, and that's a question that gets raised a lot, you know, and the whole thing of the once saved, always saved kind of thing, no matter what. And that's usually when people say that, that's what they mean. Once saved, always saved, no matter what. Yeah, I can go live a life in the toilet afterwards, but hey, I got that piece of paper when I was 7 years old. Yeah. And so, you know, here it's right action. James draws a very close connection between faith and action. And he asks very clearly, what good is it? And this, I guess, in some ways gets back to where we started. What good is it, brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but do not have works? Can faith save you? James' answer is no. If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says, go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill, but you don't supply their bodily needs, big deal. What good is that? Are you really doing service? God loves you. Jesus loves you, and so do I. Walk on down the street. That's where we have to have discretion sometimes, but that's tough. James says if you see them and they really are in need and you don't help them, boy, man, that's not what Jesus said, did he? I mean, he didn't say anything in Matthew chapter 25 about I was hungry and you gave me food and thirsty and you gave me drink and naked and you gave me clothes and sick and in prison and you came and saw me come into the kingdom. But when did we see? Well, when you did it to this guy that was in the gutter. You were doing it to me. When you did it for this lady that was down and out, you did it for me. And he looks at the other and says, well, I was hungry and you didn't give me anything. I was thirsty. You didn't even give me a drink. I was naked. You didn't clothe me, et cetera, et cetera. Whoa, time out. When did we see you? And if we'd known it was you, we would have done it. Jesus said, when you didn't do it for the least. That's what James is saying here, very clearly. There has to be a connection between faith and action. In fact, James would argue that if you claim to have faith, but you do not do appropriate actions or deeds, your faith is insufficient. That's hard. That means he says right here, faith by itself, if it has no works, it's dead. And so are you. See, I love the letter of James because it says all kinds of stuff like that. I hate the letter of James because it says all kinds of stuff like that. And I love it when I talk to other folks and say, you know, now James, but then I hate it when I get back to thinking, if you'd had a mirror. It's not that works produce salvation. They don't. But James says to proclaim faith without demonstrating that faith is empty. It's empty. Christian action is the evidence of true faith. I think we can. But I think that's where we have to have some sense of discretion. But at the same time, I think we have to be in serious prayer and consideration and let the Spirit lead. But at the same time, if it gets, you know, comes to the point of neglecting family, I think we got a problem. But I think, you know, we do those things and we try to reach out. In fact, James later on, before this, James gives the definition of true religion, 1:27. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, that you visit widows and orphans in their affliction while keeping yourself unstained from the world. In other words, you do for the least, because widows and orphans were considered some of the most vulnerable, and they really were. But then in chapter 4, verse 17, I can quote it, but I'll read it instead. Well, I'll quote it first. He who knows what is right to do but fails to do it commits sin. Anyone then who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it commits sin. That's faith in works. You know the right thing to do is to serve. You know the right thing to do is to help that person. And then you don't do it. James says, well, you just committed a sin. And it's not just a sin against that person, it's a sin against the God who cares for that person just as much as he cares for you or for me. So we talk about service. We do all kinds of things in serving, some in small ways, some in greater ways, some in real flashy ways. They got to have the TV cameras there whenever they pass out the stuff. But Jesus and James all say it's got to start here. Got to start here and here. And that is not an easy thing. I can stand up and talk this stuff day in and day out. But when I really listen to myself, I'm nowhere near where I should be either. But then again, I guess, as I tell folks all the time, I say, you know, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you therefore must be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And don't sit around and say, well, you know, I can't ever be perfect, so I just won't try. No, that just means that you always have something to work for, to move closer and closer. Well, it's the same thing with the service. Instead of giving up, we always have something more toward which to work. Anyone? Questions? Care to add anything?
That kind of goes back to where we started off. When the opportunity comes your way, how do you guy is going to get in a one-year-old van and drive off or something like that.
Well, I think you just have to. Well, usually, as I said, usually I don't give money like that. If a station close enough and I can, I do that. But
at the gas station one time, and he was in a hurry to get the Spartanburg, he left his wallet and everything else, you know.
I hope he doesn't get pulled over, because if he left his wallet, he doesn't have his driver's license either.
But I told him, I said, well, I tell you what, I said, I've got 20 gallons on the Cavallo car or something like that, and I pumped 2 gallons of gas in his car. You know, right
yeah.
There, gallon of gas
yeah.
He probably got a full tank if he hung around there.
But
yeah.
Yeah. But you know, that's the thing. You know, you have to, and just have to, there are times that I see folks and I don't do a thing, and there are other times when just something about something clicks and says, you know, you really ought to go over here and buy them one of these unhealthy meals and give it to them, so the thing.
Well, a lot of times people, when they're panhandling or something like that, I'll say, let's go call United Ministries or something like that, or Salvation Army, and I'll say, oh,
yeah.
No, you know, they don't want to do that. And when they get into that mode, I say, hey, the opportunity was there.
Right.
Drop the ball.
So, I mean, it's really not an easy answer.
No.
But I think we have to be open to the leading or that feeling that tugs and says, you know, and in the back of your mind says, you know, you ought to really do this time.
Yeah.
And I, you know, even the fact I will not forget that morning that I took a different route and somebody was standing there hungry and I swung through Hardee's and got them 2 sausage biscuits, hash browns, and a large coffee and came back around and a guy standing there went to give it to me. He said, I don't want that. I want money. I said, well, your sign says you're hungry. You will work for food. He said, well, but I want the money. I don't want the food. I said, well, I'm sorry. And I drove off and started through downtown Greenville and saw a guy that looked like he was kind of down on his luck. And when I watched him do like this in the top of the trash can,
yeah,
roll down the window, said, you hungry? You want this? I mean, time I got half a block up to the traffic light, one biscuit was already gone.
Yeah.
Anything else? I don't know if I give up my country, Hank.
I think it's like you say, you've got to take time, and your growth and your spirituality will lead you with prayer and everything else. Is this right or wrong?
And I think that's being open. That's being open to it. Okay. Anything else? Because we've gotten to 5 till now. Can't help everybody, but someone seeks you out for, or you find that, yeah, as you come along, right? No. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand that, Cindy. Yes. Except when they're on the way to Florida and they came off the interstate and this was the first church they encountered. I've had that one too. This is the first church that I saw. You came off here and you must have had blinders on when you came down the road, right? But yeah. Oh, I know. And it may not be the money. We're thinking about money and buying stuff and giving people money. It may be that they didn't, yeah. Yeah. And that's service. That is service. not everybody can listen, not everybody can talk appropriately. Some of us can talk incessantly, but not everybody can talk appropriately. Right. Right. Yeah. And that coworker that there's just not something right about the way they're looking today. And then when you say something to them and they break down crying, you know, he's.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Nobody can get close to nobody, know anybody to be able to help them with somebody that's out of their
problem. That's what I've always seen as the advantage of a smaller church. I grew up in smaller churches. And, thank y'all. Next week we'll have an even smaller crowd because we're going to talk about stewardship. No. But God bless you. Thank you, and go in peace.